It's almost about that time. Right about now.
Right about now. Right about, right about, right about now.
Hello, this is Mark Watney, astronaut. I'm entering this log for the record, in case I don't make it. It is 06:53 on Sol 19, and I'm alive.
Oh, you certainly are. That was Matt Damon from the 2015 hit film The Martian. Great movie. And my guest today is the author of the best-selling book on which that movie is based, Andy Weir. Hello, everybody. My name is Jonathan Small, and this is Right About Now. So happy to have you with me today. So on the show, I love to give my listeners just a big, broad overview of the writing business and the writing craft. And I try to have writers, editors, and different literary types of all stripes talk to me about what they do for a living and what they've learned while doing it. So I had really wanted to focus on a science fiction writer, and I figured why not go to the top? I don't read a lot of science fiction myself, but the one science fiction book that I did read and thoroughly enjoyed was The Martian by Andy Weir, my guest. So here's how it all happened. I noticed that he had a new book out called Artemis. So I decided to email him and see if he wanted to be on the show. You know, I don't know Andy personally. My podcast is relatively new. So I figured it might be a little bit of a long shot, a moonshot, if you will. But what the heck? So I reached out to him. At 4:47 a.m. the next morning, I got an email back from him saying, "Hey, please run stuff like this through my publicist," and he gives me the publicist's name. I learned my lesson last time around to just let a professional handle the scheduling of stuff like this. Smiley face. So I did what I was told. I reached out to his publicist, and within minutes, an interview was scheduled. So Andy is up in Silicon Valley, so we had to do it over the phone, which is a bummer because I really wanted to meet him in person. But I was thrilled anyway, and he was so open and candid about sharing his story, his phenomenal story about how he went from this kind of unknown computer programmer to a best-selling novelist, one of the premier writers in the science fiction world today. And his story is definitely a Cinderella story, if there ever was one. And as you'll see, it didn't just happen to him overnight. He worked. He sweated and slaved over writing. It took him 20 years of frustration of being rejected by publishers, of having to self-publish before this phenomena that was The Martian even happened to him. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure on him to follow up The Martian with another great book, and he did just that. And we talk about the process that he went through in writing Artemis, all the world building he did, all the extensive research, all the science that goes into a book like this, not to mention the character development and the plot twists. And we get into it all. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. I hope you enjoyed as much as I enjoyed doing it. You know, I told him it would only be 30 minutes. We went into 40 minutes. I could have gone for 4 hours, but I'll take what I got.
Andy Weir, welcome to Right About Now.
Hi, thanks.
It is fantastic to have you. I'm a big fan. Love your writing, and excited to have you on.
Good to be here.
So tell me a little bit about just a little backstory here. You know, when you first sort of discovered science fiction for the first time in your childhood, tell me about that. Is it very memorable for you?
No, it isn't, because I was just kind of always into it. So I don't remember a time when it like clicked for me or anything. However, there was a huge uptick in interest right around my tweens, like when I was 11 or 12. My dad had an inexhaustible supply of science fiction from his youth that he had never thrown away. It was all on a giant bookshelf. And I started plowing through those books. And so there was this like right around the time when I became a juvenile is when I started really enjoying the juveniles from the 50s and 60s.
What were some of the books that were on the shelf?
Well, it was a lot of Heinlein and Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke. I read. I was an avid Heinlein reader. Some examples are all of the robot stuff by Isaac Asimov, like I, Robot, Caves of Steel, The Naked Sun, Robots of Dawn. And then like a bunch of the early Heinlein stuff, which I really loved. Don't like late Heinlein very much, but early like Heinlein.
Early Heinlein. You like that.
Tunnel in the Sky, The Rolling Stones, Have Spacesuit, Will Travel. Stuff like that. And Clark, of course, is like all sorts of stuff. But like, I think my favorite of his was Rama. I didn't care as much about like 2001 and the stuff that he was really known for. Although I did like The Sentinel, which is a short story he wrote that was what 2001 was based on. But anyway. So, like, I would read my father's books, and I mean, these are the original books. Like, they have the yellowed, kind of cracking pages, and an ad for Kent cigarettes halfway through the book. I mean,
yeah, it's perfect. My grandfather was a big sci-fi fan, and when he died, my mom gave me a book, and it still had the cigarette burn on the cover that he, you know, sort of when he fell asleep reading it. I think I never forget that. And your dad was a physicist, correct? So you had science in your life.
Yeah. And my mom and it was an engineer. And by the way, they're both still fine. They're just retired.
Okay. Yes, they are physicists and engineers.
But the use of the past tense refers to they no longer do that for a profession, but they're fine.
They're fine. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
They're fine.
Yes. That's wonderful to hear. So when did you start having an interest in actually doing the writing yourself?
Well, you know, again, I hate to sound boring, but like I don't remember a time when I wasn't coming up with stories. Like when I was 6 years old, I was writing like Henry Huggins fan fiction, you know, the Beverly Cleary novels that I was reading back then. I would write like my own little stories with Henry and Ribsy having adventures. They, you know, I was 6 years old playing around on my parents' typewriter, so the stories lacked structure.
But they had a lot of letters. Yeah.
In my teen years, I would fill up, spiral notebooks with handwritten short stories. In fact, a friend of mine found one recently that I had written when I was in high school. And then somehow it ended up in my college buddy's like a box of college crap. Like, I don't know how it got there, but he found that. And I was like, oh, hey, Andy, check this out. And he handed it to me. It was just like, it was weird because it had been so long since I'd written it. I didn't remember it.
Was it science fiction?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I didn't remember anything about it. So I'm just reading it. I'm like, oh, this story kind of sucks.
I was going to say, is this your next book? No, not.
No, it is not.
Definitely like, not. This was not Artemis.
Turns out at age 17, I was not quite the writer I am now.
Right. But you were always writing science fiction from the time you sort of could write.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about, well, we'll start with The Martian here, because The Martian is sort of a fantasy, amazing story for a writer. What happened to you? Right?
Yeah. You fantasize about this stuff, but you never think it's going to actually happen, right?
It's amazing. So take us through it. You started writing The Martian as on your blog, correct?
Yeah, right. It was just a website, just my website. And I'd been writing. I'd been putting stuff on that website for 10 years by this point. And just, you know, web comics, short stories, and I was writing some serial fiction. And The Martian was one of three serial fiction stories that I was writing. So it was like, it was just one of many things I was up to. But it did pretty well, and people really liked it. And so when I was done, I went ahead and self-published it to Amazon, mainly because people were asking for people said like, hey, I like this story, but I don't want to read it in a web page. Can you make an e-reader version? And I did that and posted that for free. And then other people were like, oh, well, I like your story and I see there's an e-reader version, but I'm not very technically savvy and I don't know how to download a thing from the internet and put it on my Kindle. Can you just post it to Amazon? So I did that. And then it got really, really popular. It sold really well, and like that got the attention of Random House, and things kind of like skyrocketed from there. And it's like, it's one of those things where I look back on it and I'm like, I have no idea what I did right. Like,
right. You weren't following any kind of strategy. It was just, you were just doing what you love.
It was just bungling along. And I still don't, I mean,
yeah. Cause I'm wondering, how did people find that? Like, did you have a lot of subscribers to your website at that point?
Well, I had about it wasn't as refined as to have subscribers. it wasn't even like a blog, a formal blog or anything. It was just my website, and I had a mailing list, mm-hmm. an email list. And I had about 3,000 people on that email list, which I'd accumulated over 10 years. So, you know, that takes a while. And they were, I think, the core audience that helped kind of jumpstart it on Amazon. Like those readers who liked it went to Amazon and reviewed it. Like they said, like, you know, they gave it their honest reviews, and they were overwhelmingly positive because they're my fans, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that helped get it like started, like getting it onto the suggested lists when people searched for science fiction and stuff like that, and that gave them a try. Also, the price point, I set it to the minimum Amazon would allow, because really I was just trying to give it away. I wasn't really going for profit, and so Amazon won't let you set the price below 99 cents, or at least at the time that's what it was. I don't know what it is now, might still be. And so I set it to 99 cents.
So you really just, you listened to your audience and you just gave them what they wanted and you did what you loved and look what happened.
Yeah. But lots of people do that and this doesn't happen to them. So I don't know what is different about my story.
I have one idea. The book was really good. That's one thing that's very different. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So the Martian comes out. And so you had another job at this point. You were doing that as a labor of love, your writing, but you actually had another job to pay the rent, correct?
Yeah. I was a software engineer for 25 years.
Right.
And by the way, for the record, The Martian isn't, you know, oftentimes people think that, you know, I just woke up one day, wrote The Martian and became successful. There's about 20 years of really crappy, unskilled writing that came before that. You know, I paid my dues, you know, I put in the time and the effort. And also I wrote two entire books before then and had the standard tale of woe that all authors have, which is, you know, can't find a publisher, can't find an agent who's interested. Nobody cares about it. No one's interested. You know,
what do you think it was about The Martian that really caught on?
That's what I don't know.
Yeah.
Because when I wrote it, I honestly thought that I was writing for this teeny tiny 0.001% niche audience of people who literally want to see the math written out in the text. Like, I mean, The Martian is basically a series of algebra problems. I have no idea why it became mainstream popular. The only thing I can think of is the humor. Like, mm-hmm. it's funny. People like to laugh. People empathized with the main character because Mark Watney is kind of the sort of guy you'd like to have a beer with. And so once you have somebody caring about the main character in a survival story, also, I think it may have had a certain amount of uniqueness to it because the sci-fi I grew up reading is very aspirational. Like the future is cool. I mean, they have problems, but the future is cool. Oh, look at this. You can just go to Mars. Yeah. Yeah. You know,
right.
It's awesome. Right. But nowadays sci-fi is like the future is a dismal fascist nightmare scape.
Yes, it's true. The future has changed. It's not future land.
Waiting for us, but dystopian misery, you know? And I think the sci-fi market is kind of saturated with this, you know, misery future kind of thing. And so something like The Martian, that's just aspirational. There's no antagonist. It's literally everyone working together.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned humor is a great, I mean, it was what helped me get into The Martian. The humor was my entry point, but also the way you describe science, you know, there's a lot, you learn a lot reading that book, but you don't feel like you're reading a textbook. Like it's put in
right.
layman's terms.
That's where the humor came in. 'Cause The Martian is all about scientific problems and scientific solutions. And so it requires an enormous amount of exposition to the reader on topics that they probably wouldn't be that interested in normally. So humor is how you get away with it. A person will read anything if it makes them laugh. If I describe to you like the Piccadilly Station London train time schedule, you would probably get bored. But if I found a way to do it where you laughed your ass off every five paragraphs, you'd be happy to keep listening. And in the end, you would accidentally know the train schedule for building the Piccadilly Station.
Is this something you discovered on The Martian, or had you been doing that in your other books as well?
No, it's something I discovered in The Martian, and obviously something I carried on with Artemis, the first person smartass narrator.
Sure. Yeah, it's very similar.
One thing I do need to learn, though, is I need to figure out how to have a narrative voice that isn't first person smartass, because if I just stick with what I'm doing, my books are going to just start seeming really the same. Hmm. And so I need to have, I want to keep the comedy, but I want to do it with an omniscient narration. So like Terry Pratchett, Douglas Adams, you know, these are like also writers that I greatly enjoy. I read a lot more than just science fiction. It's just I only feel comfortable writing science fiction.
Right. Have you done a lot of writing in the third person? It's something that I have been challenged with. Yeah, you have. Okay.
And my previous two novels, the ones that flopped, didn't get to a position where they could flop. The ones that, you know,
right.
They were written third person, but with a very serious tone. And, you know, it's like for my next book, I think I should try to transition into third person narration and keep the humor. So the humor would have to come either from a funny narration style like Pratchett or Adams,
mm-hmm.
or it would have to be that the narration itself is like minor and hiding in the background and the characters are really funny. Like, the characters would have to be like their interplay, their actions and their statements. That's where I have to make the reader laugh. And then if I do that, that means the narration itself can't be the headline. It has to be
the straight man.
Very
almost.
Much.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has to be very much in the background.
Right.
And I'm not sure that. So this, we just happened to touch on the thing that I'm struggling with at the moment is how to find that voice and make it work.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll figure it out. You're good at these things.
I hope so.
Let's talk about Artemis. So The Martian comes out. It's obviously a huge success, the book and then the movie that it's based on. And then your life, I'm sure, changes radically, correct? I mean, how can we explain kind of what happened to you after all that happened for you with
The
Martian?
I mean, once The Martian did so well and there was a movie and all that stuff, first off, I went from being like a guy who spent his life in a cubicle to, you know, hanging out with Hollywood elite and going,
right.
And then, you know, the big change was going from, so I like computer programming. I mean, I liked my job. I liked my day job. I liked my coworkers. I liked my boss. I found it very rewarding and fulfilling, and I enjoyed it. And so giving up that job, I held on to it a lot longer than probably I should have. Because then, you know, I held on to it till really I just did not have enough time to do both of my jobs. And then I finally stopped being an engineer. But, you know, I miss it. And so that was the biggest adjustment for me, was to go from working on a team in an office environment to being alone all day, you know, just in my home office writing. And that's, I'm a fairly social guy. And so that was a change for me that I didn't, you know, that was hard. No one's really going to feel that sorry for me, but, you know.
Well, but writing can be a very solitary job. I mean, I think that's why you find a lot of writers like in cafes and Starbucks and stuff. They just want to be around people. It's not that you want to show off that you're writing screenplay. Like, I do that all the time. I go and find, you know, it's hard to just be alone in your room writing all day.
Yeah, I can't write with other people around, but I miss having other people around when I'm not writing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So you're better at writing just on your own. You can't have this sort of distraction.
I can't have the distractions of a coffee shop. Also, I don't know if I'm a fossil or what, but I need a proper desktop system with a nice big heavy keyboard and a mouse. I can't do laptop chiclet keyboards.
Yeah. Do you listen to music when you write?
Sometimes. And when I do, it has to be instrumental, because if there's lyrics, then that occupies the language area of my brain and I fumble up on the typing.
Yeah.
Another reason I kind of need to be alone is I generally like to say dialogue out loud to make sure that it flows well. And so that's just me talking to myself. People would be like, there's a crazy guy in the corner of the coffee shop.
Or they'd be like, there's an annoying guy talking on his cell phone. Yeah. Yeah. Through his wire. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. And do you have like a sort of a writing ritual that you do before you write? Is there sort of one kind of way you get set for writing every time?
Well, first I have to get the goat to the altar. And then, no, I don't know. I don't really do any specific ritual. I just sit down and get to work. Generally, I have to be, like, basically all my physical needs need to be not bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to be well fed. You know,
right.
I need to be not hungry. I need to be clean, showered-wise. You know, I need to be, you know, stuff like that. I do my best writing usually after lunch. Because in the morning, I usually spend the morning doing, like, for lack of a better term, housekeeping, work-wise, like answering emails, scheduling meetings, stuff like this, talking to doing interviews. Yeah. And then also I answer all fan mail. So like I have a personal response to every fan mail.
You responded to mine. I was like, whoa, yep. That was awesome. Yeah. Thank you for doing that.
Sure, no problem. And that doesn't take that long. I'm not J.K. Rowling or anything like that. I don't have like millions and millions of fans like deluging my inbox. It takes me about half an hour a day tops to answer all the fan mail.
Right.
But it's a thing that's nice. It requires very little brain power. Usually a lot of them I just say, thanks, glad you liked it. Thank you. Because a lot of them are just like, hey, I really liked your book. I'm like, thanks.
Why do you think you do that? Why do you think you take such a personal approach to that?
I don't know. I guess, they took the time to email me. I figure I should take the time to reply. I mean, just courtesy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
When it comes to that sort of stuff, like I consider myself fortunate to have been successful so late in life. Like, so The Martian, I think I was 42 when it came out. When it came out in print, I was 42. And so that is nice because I had 4 decades of, being humbled by life before I had my success. And so it didn't really have that big of an effect on me. Like I didn't get a swelled head or anything, I don't think. So I'm not such a big shot that I don't have time to answer emails, you know?
Oh, that's great. Let's talk about Artemis. In the book, you turn your focus from Mars to the moon, and Artemis is a city in the future that is on the moon, or inside the moon, I guess, or under the moon. I don't know.
It's on the surface.
It's on the surface of the moon.
Well, half of it's underground, half of it's above ground. It's in a bunch of spheres.
Bubbles. I think you have the Armstrong bubble. And where did this idea come from? I mean, where is this a real thing, that this idea of building a city on the moon? Like, did you read it from the headlines, or did you something you kind of?
Well, I mean, I'm hardly the first person to come up with that idea.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the idea of building a city on the moon goes back to, I don't know, forever ago. But I wanted to get into the nitty gritty. Basically, I started with the concept of I want to write a story that takes place in humanity's first city that is not on Earth. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even start the moon. I was like, what about Mars? But I concluded that the first city ever for humanity that is not on Earth is definitely going to be on the moon. There's just no way that we would skip the moon and go to Mars. That would be like the ancient Britons colonizing North America before they colonized Wales. I mean,
right.
It would make no sense whatsoever. So I'm like, all right, it's definitely going to be on the moon. Next question, why? Why build a city on the moon? I want there to be a city on the moon, by God. I'm going to come up with a reason. What is the reason? Cities don't happen without an economic reason. There's always, every city in the world exists or existed because there was some economic reason for it to exist. So people aren't just going to go to the moon and live there just to say, I live on the moon. There has to be some reason. And so I decided it's tourism. A lot of stories that feature moon cities or whatever they say the city exists. The economic reason is they're mining the moon. I'm like, well, why don't you send robots to mine the moon? That's a lot better than sending people because, we care when people die.
Right. Exactly.
And so all those things, all those kind of standard explanations for, they did it to get away from population pressure. It's like, well, then colonize the ocean. That's easier. Right? Oh, okay. Well, they did it to escape persecution. Like, if you can afford to build a freaking city on the moon, you're not the persecuted.
Exactly.
And so I'm like, but tourism is a good answer because it's like, it is by definition people being there, humans being there. So I developed I kind of tried to come up with, okay, how would the tourism industry work on the moon? And why would you go to the moon? Well, probably the biggest draw for tourism on the moon would be the Apollo 11 landing site. So Artemis is very near to that. And also the one science fiction conceit I had to make is that commercial space travel has driven the price down to the point that middle class people can afford to go into space and by extension can afford to go to the moon.
I love that detail of how people go on, tours of the Apollo space station and go out, put on their EVA suits or whatever again. I thought that was such, and it brings up this idea of, you had to do a lot of, I guess what they call world building, in Hollywood. How do you world build? Do you have a process?
Oh God, that's the fun part. I wish that could just be my whole job. I mean, the pesky characters and plot structure and interplay and actually writing things down, that's hard. World building is fun as hell.
I've never done it, and it sounds, when I read a book like yours, I want to do it because it's just so inspirational.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's just, I love thinking about all the little details and stuff like that. So I started off with saying, like, well, it's a city and it's a tourist town. Cities always kind of like, you know, develop and grow around what their economy is. So I modeled Artemis's kind of structure, ignoring the technology necessary to live on the moon, just the social strata and, like, you know, the economy of Artemis. I based it on Caribbean resort towns because they're the same thing. They're a single income economy. In other words, there's only one reason why that city exists.
Yes.
And it's for tourism, right? So Artemis is just like a Caribbean resort town. You've got the area that has all the glitzy high-end hotels and casinos and fun stuff and touristy stuff. And then the people who actually live and work there, because someone's got to clean the toilets, right? I'm not going to say squalid, but they live in much more austere conditions. You can't have a city that's nothing but rich people, right?
Right.
And so that's what the economy was based on. And then I'm like, okay, so that's what the city's going to be like. But what was really fun was working out all the technology. I'm like, all right, I want to build a city on the moon, and I've decided it costs this much money to transport a kilogram to the surface. How do I make this a profitable enterprise? You know, you can't just, I mean, Artemis, the entirety of that city probably weighs hundreds of millions of tons or something, right? I mean, it's a city. Cities are heavy. They didn't transport all that from Earth. The vast majority of Artemis is made of aluminum that was sourced locally from the moon. Lunar ore, which is available just laying out on the surface because you don't have dirt to dig through, is extremely rich in aluminum. So the first thing they did was drop some reactors down there and have them power a smelting complex. And then from there, they could generate aluminum, and that's what they built the city out of. And by the way, the byproduct of smelting aluminum is oxygen. So the moon just has rocks out on the surface that are made of aluminum, which you build your city with, and oxygen, which you can fill it up with. It's like the moon is just, if I had come up with this geology for a fictional planet, people would just say my story is bullshit because I made things too convenient.
Yeah. Is that why you root your fiction so much in reality? You do so much research. The science is so important to you. Is it because you want to, it needs to be real to you and to the audience?
Yeah, that's yes. The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is this is my approach to writing. My favorite kind of book to read is hard sci-fi, like scientifically accurate science. And, you know, you should always write a book that you yourself would like to read, right? And that's what I'd like to read. However, I'm not saying that other people should do that. I'm just saying this is the style that works for me.
Yeah. One of the interesting facts, the idea that one of the characters has a disability, but she came to the moon or was brought to the moon because of the way gravity is on the moon. It's not as, right. She doesn't have to be in a wheelchair. She can actually not maybe walk with assistance, but she can walk. I thought that was really interesting.
On the moon, she can walk with just crutches, but on Earth, she'd be confined to a wheelchair.
Is that something you just thought of, like in your mind, or was that something that you had, you know, like a fact like that? How do you come up with something like that?
I don't know. I came up with it. You know, when I'm writing a book, I spend a lot of time just kind of daydreaming and imagining the city itself and thinking of all the different ways you can take advantage of, you know, basically start by saying, okay, what's different? You know, what's different between Artemis and Chicago? What's different? It's like, well, I mean, in Chicago, you can buy a Twinkie for a fairly small amount of money. But in Artemis, that Twinkie had to be shipped from Earth.
Right.
So you can't have a Twinkie. Or you can, but it costs a lot. So what do people eat for snack food? You know, yeah. It's like, I don't know.
And algae,
so it's
like, and the gunk, where you go, yeah, gunk. Or...
Yeah, gunk, yeah, yeah. Locally grown. Although maybe they have ways of making... Yeah, I didn't go too far down that rat hole, but I was thinking of things of like, okay, once you have algae... Once you have gunk, it's chlorella algae that has glucose in it. So if you could probably process gunk to get the glucose out. Now you've got glucose. So now you got sugar. And yeah. Then I'm kind of wondering, okay, now what else can you do here? And yeah, maybe you could make a confection on the moon that actually tastes good.
And apparently coffee tastes terrible on the moon. I had no idea.
Yes. I had fun with that too.
That was fun. coffee.
That was fun because it's like, okay, Artemis's air pressure is 21% of an atmosphere, of Earth's sea level atmosphere, and it's pure oxygen. And no, that does not make things more flammable or dangerous. It's the exact same. Fires would burn in Artemis at the exact same rate that they would burn at sea level on Earth because it's the same partial pressure of oxygen. But yeah, they do that because that makes it easier and safer on the engineering. The hulls don't need to be as thick, and that's what the Apollo program did. The problem with the coffee is that when you lower air pressure, the boiling point of water goes down. And so the boiling point of water in Artemis is 61 degrees Celsius, which is about 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Hmm. And so the coffee just really doesn't get very hot.
Right. So it's, if you like iced coffee, it's a good, yeah. No.
No, well, I mean, you could certainly make iced coffee, but it also won't steep correctly because the water doesn't get hot enough. And then I got so much feedback from that. Like so many people said, wait, you know, they'd be willing to give up their, you know, lives of luxury and live in completely austere conditions on the moon, but they would never give up coffee. So they're like, all right, no, you make it in a pressure cooker or you cold brew it or you do this and that, you know. Another problem in Artemis that I haven't covered, that I didn't cover in the book, but I later realized, is that at lower atmospheric pressure, your taste buds don't work as well. Everything just kind of tastes more dull, which is, to answer Jerry Seinfeld's immortal question, that is the deal with airline food. That's part of the reason airline food tastes bad, is because your tongue doesn't work correctly. When you're in flight in an airplane, the atmospheric pressure inside the airplane is much lower than that of sea level.
So interesting.
So if you were in Artemis, even imported food would taste a little bit bland. And so I came up with the idea of, like, if there was like a 5-star restaurant in Artemis that was in the entire restaurant is in a 1-atmosphere pressure. Right. And so you go in through an airlock and then you can enjoy food and it tastes really good. Then you have to spend 4 hours in a decompression chamber, slowly going back down to Artemis standard.
Wow.
So that you can, because otherwise you'd get the bends.
Exactly. You've thought it all through. That's the great thing. So we don't have to.
Yeah. Well, you were asking about world building. This is like, yeah. You can tell that I just love that
you
stuff.
You love it. And so do you have like a Bible that like a literally like a physical document that has all this, or is it kind of all in your brain somewhere?
No. It's documents. I can't remember any. I generally have like files in my, so there's a folder called Artemis, and in there there's like, and it's not well organized. It's like there's a document called stuff.doc and another one called more stuff.doc. And
the main character, Jazz, she's of Saudi descent. Her father, I believe, is a welder, or he's a, yes. I guess everybody's an immigrant to, but she's actually born there.
No, she was born in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, but, you're right.
Emigrated there when she was 6 years old. So she grew up in Artemis. And,
right. So she doesn't even want to go back to Earth because she's afraid she'll get gravity sickness.
She would get gravity sickness, and it would be a slow recovery time to readapt to Earth gravity. But second off, she just has no connection to Earth. Her culture is Artemis. Her home is Artemis. And she mentioned it a few times in the book. She actually, like, say what you will about Jazz and her demeanor and her sometimes grumpy outlook, she loves her town.
Yeah, she does. She's very provincial in that way, and she's a moon girl.
Moon gal.
Why did you make that decision to make her from Saudi Arabia?
I did all the world building on Artemis before I came up with any characters or story. So I had completely like designed the city and everything about it. And I did that on purpose. First off, because world building is fun and I like doing it more than I like doing real writing. And second off, because readers are very clever. They can tell, they can smell, even if they don't see it on a conscious level, they can tell when a writer has made an adjustment to the setting for the convenience of the story. You know, it's like hard. I can't come up with a concrete example at the moment, but I think we've all had times where we're reading a story and there's some aspect of the setting which turns out to be important for a critical plot. And you're like, well, that's kind of dumb. I don't see how that setting could work that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, wait, how would that even work?
Right. Exactly.
How can you have your, you know, why are your elections based on who can arm wrestle the best? I don't see this scaling as a culture, you know. And so I wanted to design Artemis in its entirety, have it be internally consistent, and I want everything to make sense as a city, and then make a story that takes place in that city. So the story has to work around the setting, not the other way around.
Got it.
So I swear I am answering your question. It's
no,
just
no.
a long answer.
I hear you.
So then the next thing I did was I said, like, okay, now it's time to come up with a story. So I had all of Artemis design, time to make a story that takes place in it. So I came up with a story, and it was nothing like the book that you read. It was like a completely different story. My first idea for a story was like completely different main characters, different story, different plot, different everything. And the story had need of, you know, I just kind of outlined it, right? The story needed in like two or three scenes, a lovable rogue, a smuggler who was like an extremely minor character, a tertiary character. Mm-hmm. And so I created Jazz. And I'm like, oh, and I created her out of whole cloth. I basically said, like, all right, I need a smuggler type. Artemis is a very international city, so I liked to go like, well, what's a country I haven't used yet? And I kind of like spun a mental globe and said, like, oh, Saudi Arabia. We'll make the smuggler be from Saudi Arabia, and we'll make the smuggler a woman too, just because why not? Because women are more interesting than men.
And your last protagonist was a man, so yeah, let's try it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no. She wasn't the protagonist at this time.
Oh, at that time, right. Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, at this time, she was like this very, very tertiary character who was literally only going to be in like two or three scenes in the whole book. Like, she was like a very much a nothing character.
Okay.
Well, for reasons unrelated to her, I didn't like this story. I was like, this isn't going anywhere. This plot doesn't work. The storyline is clumsy. The characters are lame. Forget it. Right. So I came up with a different story, a new story idea. And I plucked aspects of the first story that I liked and put them into the second story as well. So in the second story, Jazz ended up being a little more prominent. She was a secondary character now, and I had to define her a little bit deeper. I defined that, oh, she grew up in Artemis, and her dad is a blue-collar guy. And she's kind of scoundrelly but likable or whatever. But still, she wasn't the main character. She was a secondary character. So I had this whole other story. I didn't like that story either. And so I'm like, okay, well, what have I got that I do like? And I looked through the things, and there are elements of the story that I liked. But one thing is, I'm like, well, this character Jazz is pretty interesting. Maybe I could write a book about her. And that means it'd be a crime novel or a heist story or something like that. But I like those too. So I'm going to make her the main character. And then I came up with a story idea for that and worked it through, and it felt good. And that's what became Artemis. And by this time, when I started writing the actual book, by this time, Jazz was so cemented in my mind as being a Saudi woman, you know, all this stuff, that if I tried to change her, my imagination would have rebelled.
And she was telling you kind of what the story was in a way, right?
Yeah. And so this is how I ended up writing a protagonist who is like a 26-year-old Saudi woman welder, you know, write what you know. Yeah.
Right.
I am none of those four things.
But, you know, you're scrappy and, you know.
No, her personality for sure. I mean, like, so Mark Watney is just me, but he's he's the good parts of me. He's all the aspects of my personality that I like and none of my many, many flaws. Jazz is a little bit more like the real me.
How so? She's
well, the real me as of when I was her age. So she's 26 and I was a screw up at 26, like her, like basically not meeting my potential, not.
She's definitely a big partier. I mean, she drinks, you know, she can get drunk.
Yeah.
Not really in the book. We hear a lot about it. We don't really see it so much in the book. We just hear about her past.
She has regrets of her past, right?
Exactly. Like,
she has a lot of regrets about decisions she's made.
Now, is that actually brings up my question that there's that pen pal correspondence that goes throughout the book that she has with somebody on Earth. And I wondered why you used, what purpose of that device was for you as a writer.
I wanted to tell the reader about things that happened in Jazz's past without flashbacks, without taking up a whole bunch of time. And it was a really good avenue for me to do that because there are these really short interchapter passages that don't take up much time. And it allowed me to just pluck out the relevant parts of her life between age 6 and 26 without having to tell the tale of her youth, right? And so it let me pick and choose the most important moments and tell the story up to then. And then later on, you find out that her pen pal, Kelvin, is integral to the current plot.
Yeah, yeah. So, I didn't want to give away any spoilers, but that is true.
But, yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of I would imagine a lot of my listeners are aspiring science fiction writers, or even if they're not aspiring science fiction writers, what is the advice you give to people who are just starting out?
first off, my advice is not genre or setting specific. I mean, if you want to write, you know, historical fiction, there is no reason for you to force yourself to write science fiction. You know, write what you want to write, for sure. So, but for anyone who's starting out writing or trying to write or beating their head against the wall, here's a few bits of advice I have. Number one, you have to write to be a writer. You have to put words into a document. It's not enough to sit around and do world building or think about how awesome this scene's going to be or that scene or work out the finer details of a character's backstory. You have to actually sit down at your computer and make words come out. Mm-hmm. Because when the story is in your mind and you haven't written anything on it yet, it's perfect. The instant you start writing it, that's when you find all the problems.
Yeah.
Right. And so that, like,
and the solution thing, sometimes, I think.
Well, yeah, you better find the solution. That's writing. That's your job.
Exactly.
You know? So number one is you have to write. Don't just daydream. Don't just think about it. Sit down and write stuff. The worst thing that can happen is you're like, well, this sucks, and you delete it and start over. Right. Number two, and this is the hardest one, and this is sometimes catches people off guard. Don't tell your story to your friends and family. Hmm. Not verbally. You have to resist that urge. Even if they ask you, refuse, or, you know, be polite about it, but just say, no, I'm still working on it. You know, whatever. Here's the thing. Most writers, not all, but most, myself for sure, are driven by a desire to have an audience. You want an audience. You want people to experience the story that you're telling.
Right.
Right. When you tell the story verbally to your friends, it satisfies that need for an audience, and it saps your will to actually write it. So you're much less likely to write a book if you get to keep telling people about the book.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
My recommendation is you make a rule for yourself, an ironclad rule. Nobody gets to experience this story by any means other than reading it. Now, you can still write it a chunk at a time. You don't need to present an entire book before anybody hears about your story. You've got your friends, you've got your trusted circle, you've got your beta readers, right? You can write a section or a chapter and then hand it to them and say, hey, maybe tell me what you think, or, you know, or don't if you don't have the time, but whatever. But you can still, you know, incrementally tell them the story in that fashion to get the sweet, sweet validation that you crave. Right? You don't have to wait to finish the whole book, but make it a rule that you, in fact, you can turn that into a motivator in that, like, man, I really want my dad to see this. I just need to finish this section so that I can show it to dad. You know, that sort of thing.
And it's hard because your friends will say, well, what, tell me what the book's about. Everybody wants to know what the book's about.
Especially if you're onto something, good. Mm-hmm. If you've got a cool plot line and your friends aren't just placating you by listening to you ramble. By the way, also all writers everywhere, your story is more interesting to you than it is to other people. So when you're talking about it to other people, 80% of the time, they're just waiting for you to move on to another topic. But right. When you do have a genuinely good idea, when you're onto something, they will start prodding you. They'll be like, whoa, well, wow, that was... Oh, wow. No, that's cool. Wait, what about this guy? Doesn't he want to blah, blah, blah? You know, and that's, you know, when your friends start to become your audience, it's a good feeling, but it also means that your friends will be like, well, what's going to happen next? And you're like, well, let me write it. You know,
and you don't want them to influence. You don't want, you know, like when you take too many suggestions and stuff, that can really muddy the waters.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've also got to grow armor on that. In that, if people start suggesting things to you, you have to be able to just go like, well, no, I've got a plot flow in mind that I'm doing.
Right.
And then the final piece of advice is that there's never been a better time ever to self-publish. There's no longer an old boy network between you and the reader. You don't have to convince a publisher that your story is worthwhile in order to let readers see it. You can just, you can, for literally $0, with absolutely no financial risk to you at all, you can put it out there for people to read. And that's great.
And you're living proof of that, for sure.
I'm living proof of that. Although I want to be clear, going through a traditional publisher is definitely better, in my opinion, because they know how to do publicity and marketing. They know how to get it into the hands of reviewers, and they know how to bring awareness of the book about. They know how to make that happen. So You have
also, they also have advances, and you can work.
Well, yes, yeah. Yes, for sure. There's advances and stuff. But if you make two parallel universes and release one book self-published and release the other book through a publisher, you're going to make more money from the publisher and get more exposure. So whatever you're after, money or readership, both of them, you're better off with a traditional publisher. So definitely try that route first. But if you can't break in, then consider self-pubbing. And if it starts to sell well, then turn around and go back to the publishers and say, like, look, I've got a proven product here. It is selling. These are the numbers.
Yeah. That is great advice. Let's end on that. I love it. Very inspiring. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm excited about your next book, even though I know you won't tell me what it is.
I haven't decided. I haven't told me what it is.
Okay, good. But even when you know it, I know one of your things is not to even ask. But I hope we get to go. I hope we get to go back to Artemis.
That is my plan. I mean, I want to write more stories in Artemis. I think I'm onto something. Even the negative reviews of Artemis, like, people liked Artemis. It's doing well, which is great because I was suffering from a massive imposter complex, having to follow up The Martian, right? Mm. But even the people who didn't like Artemis liked the setting. They right. said, like, oh, I hated jazz. I hated this. I thought this plot was dumb. I hated this. One star. However, the city was really cool. And so I think I'm onto something with the setting.
I mean, all I could think of is this is like an HBO, you know, this is like a Game of Thrones. Sure. I mean, you've set up a world that you want to, like, keep going back to, right? And
that's what I want.
Okay.
Hopefully a little less lethal than Game of Thrones.
Yeah, not quite as... No yeah. eyes getting gouged out.
Yeah, yeah. No, everybody keeps their eyes.
All right. Andy, have a great day. Thanks so much.
Thank you. You too.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Right About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, rightaboutnowmedia.com. And listen there. This is Ella reminding you to do the right thing.
Thanks, Ella.
You're welcome.
Perfect.
Can you listen to it?
Yeah.